The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The GIFCT database for identifying images and videos that have been flagged as violent extremism, you know, those have a slightly different problem, because generally when they catch a duplicate of a prohibited image or video, the thing that they flag really is a duplicate with some margin of error, but the technical accuracy of identifying duplicates is relatively high. The problem is that for violent extremist content, many things that are illegal in one context are legal in a different context. And so, you know, a video that's used by ISIS for recruiting in one context needs to be available for journalists and for scholars and researchers and people engaging in counter speech to use in other ways.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 7th, 2019. We're bringing you a new episode from our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 election. My colleague Evelyn Dweck and I spoke with Daphne Keller, the Director of Intermediary Liability at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, about the nuts and bolts of content moderation. People often have big ideas for how tech platforms should decide what content to take down and what to keep up. But what kind of moderation is actually possible at scale? And what happens when those decisions come into conflict with different norms of free speech, for example, between the US and Europe? We talk about intermediary liability law in the United States, recent rulings by the Court of Justice for the European Union, and everything in between. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 468, Daphne Keller on Legal Liability for Tech Platforms. So this week, Evelyn and I spoke with Daphne Keller at Stanford, and we were both really, really excited to get to talk with her about this issue.
Yeah, Daphne is just one of the leading experts in this area of platform liability. It's everyone's always thirsty for her commentary on developments in this very hot space at the moment. And I think one of the things that makes her so useful is that she's been on the inside and worked at one of these major platforms at Google. And so she really combines sort of the practical knowledge with the theoretical understanding of the issues, which means that, you know, academics like myself can often come up with things that sound really great in theory, but don't necessarily work, play out well in practice. And so I think she's done a real public service by joining the academy and sort of schooling us on why some of the things that we say and think would not necessarily be such great ideas in practice as a result of her experience. And one of the areas in which she's been a really helpful, useful voice as well is in the current domestic debate around Section 230. Section 230 is a phrase that gets thrown around in these debates a lot, and I think we're guilty in this conversation as well of just saying 230 and assuming that people who, you know, have normal lives and don't spend all of their time thinking about it know what 230 is. So maybe it would be useful, Quinta, if you could just give us a quick sort of summary of what Section 230 is and what it stands for in this debate.
Absolutely. So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is a law passed in the late 90s that functionally gives platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, smaller companies, immunity from liability from civil suit for content posted on those platforms. So, you know, if I post something on Twitter that's defaming Evelyn, Evelyn can't sue Twitter over it. And this law...
But I'll be very upset with you.
Fair enough. You can sue me, just not Twitter. And so this law has sort of become more and more prominent in recent years with rising criticism in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere over tech platforms. And there's an argument that, you know, perhaps this law should be reformed to encourage greater moderation on the part of the platforms or to encourage less moderation on part of the platforms. And Evelyn, as you say, Daphne has really been a key voice here in sort of injecting a dose of reality from the tech company's perspective on what is and isn't feasible in these discussions. But on top of Section 230, we also talked about some news on the other side of the Atlantic with Daphne as well.
Yeah, so there were two really big Court of Justice opinions in the European Union in the past couple of weeks, which people had been sort of nervously waiting for. Because unlike Section 230 in the US, the European Union has been a lot more ready to impose some liability on platforms and to order them to make certain decisions around content moderation. And there were two cases in particular that were discussing the European Union's ability to order the platforms to moderate content worldwide and not only within the European Union. So first was a right to be forgotten decision, and the question was whether Google had to delist the relevant content in that case worldwide or just sort of geo-lock it to the European Union. And the second was about a defamation ruling. And this is a really interesting and important decision, I think. Sort of people in this space have been watching it very, very closely because these are decisions and speech that in the US, for example, would definitely be protected speech under the First Amendment. And in especially in the case of the defamatory content, would not only be protected speech, but the most highly protected speech because it was about a politician. And so it's the kind of speech that the US considers especially important to be subject to the marketplace of ideas and robust debate. And so it was sort of seen as very threatening that the European Union might be looking at delisting this content worldwide or forcing the platforms to take it down worldwide. So we get into the results of those decisions and what it means going forward for these mega global platforms.
Yeah, and I think the big takeaway here is just that these are hard problems and there's not any easy solution, but happily, we have Daphne to guide us through them. So with that, let's take it away.
Daphne Keller, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you're the Director of Intermediary Liability at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, and you were previously the Associate General Counsel for Intermediary Liability, which must have been hard to say all the time, at Google. So let's start by explaining then, what is intermediary liability?
Well, it's a horrible phrase. Everybody stumbles over it, including me. And to most people, it doesn't sound very interesting, but it's actually super interesting. Intermediary liability is the set of rules that tells platforms like Facebook or other intermediaries like Cloudflare or Amazon Web Services what legal responsibility they have for the speech and information shared by their users. So depending how we set the intermediary liability rules for platforms, that drives what choices they make about what content to take down, what to leave up, whether to notify people when they've taken down their content, all kinds of things.
Great. Yeah, and it is such a dense phrase, but it absolutely affects like the internet that all of us experience absolutely every day. And it's suddenly all the rage at the moment as part of the tech clash, with a lot of laws being written and considered globally to make platforms more liable for the content that appears on their services. And you've written a lot about the kinds of considerations that go into crafting an effective intermediary liability law. So first of all, do you think any of the laws that have come out in the last little while have got it right?
I don't think any of them have it perfectly right, but I think there are a lot of bits and pieces from various laws that are pretty smart. So for example, I have a lot of issues with Germany's NetzDG law, which imposes a 24-hour takedown obligation for content that is, quote-unquote, obviously illegal. And my problems with it are that it basically creates strong incentives for platforms to take down too much or to simply use their terms of service to prohibit so much content that they don't have to worry about the law. But at the same time, NetzDG has some really good elements, one of which is a very robust transparency mandate. Big platforms that are regulated by NetzDG have to put out transparency reports every 6 months with quite a bit of detail about what they're taking down and why. And that's really useful. It's valuable to have laws that are driving platforms to tell us more about what's going on.
Just wanted to check, that transparency law is actually what Facebook was fined under. Is that correct?
It is. It's a very strange fine. So, you know, essentially, Facebook encourages users to report things under Facebook's terms of service or community guidelines instead of reporting them under the law, because that makes Facebook's life easier. They can just go look and see if something violates their community guidelines and not wrangle with German law. But the NetzDG enforcers said this violated the transparency mandate under the law because they should have been keeping track of whether or not the content was illegal or was alleged to be illegal. So that's a tough one. But there are other laws around the world that have good components also. So, for example, in Argentina, the Supreme Court precedent on point for platform liability, the Belén Rodríguez case, says that there are decisions we don't want platforms making for us. There are decisions about what speech is legal that should go to a court. And so the way that they set it up for many claims, such as defamation claims, probably, a platform doesn't have to take the content down until a court has looked at it and given full and fair process and decided whether the content is illegal or not.
And so, Daphne, we've talked about Germany, we've talked about Argentina. From the perspective of someone in the U.S., it's interesting to me that intermediary liability, which was this sort of fascinating, wonky little corner of law, has now become, as Evelyn said, sort of cool as people are newly concerned about election interference, about the influence of large platforms. Can you just spell out what the connection is between this sort of techlash and this new concern, at least within the United States, perhaps globally, with intermediary liability?
Yeah. I mean, I think as more and more of our lives have moved online, and more of our speech and our, you know, things that would previously have been diary entries or notes passed in class or, you know, just all kinds of aspects of our daily lives have moved online, they have become more subject to the power of private companies that operate things like, you know, Google Docs for your shopping list or any list for your shopping list or Reddit for your political viewpoints and so forth. And so it's, I think, totally reasonable that people are more and more concerned about what rules platforms are applying and what rules we as societies are applying to these incredibly powerful actors. So I think the attention is very well warranted. What is less warranted, to my mind, are some proposals that are coming out that are, seem to have been, you know, sort of made up by people who thought about it for a week or two and came up with something that sounded good. We don't need to do that. We don't need to make up rules out of whole cloth, or at least we don't need to start there, because we do have a lot of precedent from all over the world about various standards that people have tried, and we know something about how they play out.
Speaking of thinking about it for a couple of weeks and then rolling out a law, I have to apologize on behalf of Australia for doing exactly that.
They didn't think about it for a couple of weeks even, did they?
No, it was just 2 days.
24 hours before it was passed.
Yes, not our proudest moment. When you think about platform liability, and you were just talking about, you know, some of the existing standards and things that we have already that we can use, do you think of the problem as one big monolithic problem, or do you think actually to move forward we need to break it up and ask much more specific questions about liability? So, for example, we, you know, think about election interference and hate speech and terrorist and extremist materials online. Do you think we should be thinking about this sort of holistically, or is it better to try and disentangle the issues involved?
Well, I think it's really both. You know, I mean, there are some things that generalize to almost any rule that makes platforms liable for content. So, for example, almost any time that the rule is platform, you will get in trouble unless you take things down, that gives platforms an incentive to take down not only what's illegal, but also anything that even creates some risk of getting the platform in trouble. And so we know from lots of empirical studies of the US DMCA, for example, that over removal is very common. Platforms get allegations that are targeting perfectly legal online speech, sometimes for political reasons or sometimes for competitive reasons. And platforms very commonly just go ahead and take that stuff down rather than assume any risk. That generalizes beyond copyright to any kind of content that platforms might get in trouble for. I think we also know from copyright and from other discussions around the world that there are mechanisms you can put in place to at least try to control for that over-removal problem. For example, you can notify the accused, notify the person whose speech just got taken down, and give them an opportunity to appeal and to defend themselves. Or you can have penalties for people who bring bad faith accusations. You know, there are a lot of just mechanical rules that you can put into the process when platforms are liable for content that help protect against over removal. There's a global civil society document endorsed by groups all over the world and backed up by statements from UN level human rights experts. This list is called the Manila Principles, and it lists a bunch of procedural options. It's like a menu of procedural rules you can put in place to make a notice and takedown system less clumsy and less vulnerable to heckler's veto trying to silence people. So that's an example of something where a similar principle can apply to most kinds of claims. But in other instances, it really does not make sense to treat this as one big problem. And it does make, I think, more sense to look on a case-by-case basis. You know, there are very extreme kinds of unlawful content, like child sex abuse material, which really are recognizable by a non-expert and are urgently important to take down. And so it's not at all surprising that every country in the world, as far as I know, makes platforms responsible for taking action when they see something like that. You know, there are a rule like that makes sense for very recognizable and very dangerous content, but might not make sense, for example, for political speech about a public figure that skirts the line of being defamatory.
So, Daphne, you were in-house at Google, as Evelyn mentioned, before entering academia, and there often seems to be a big gap between the way that practitioners versus academics and others think about intermediary liability. So what's something that you wish people from the outside understood about the way that these companies think about these problems?
I think the main thing is just grasping the consequence of operating at scale. And this is something that my Stanford colleague, Alex Stamos, who was previously at Facebook, talks about quite a bit also. You know, if you look at platforms' decisions about whether to take down content and you look at just one case at a time, you know, so you look at maybe the Vietnam War era photo that Facebook took down, it's very easy to say that's ridiculous. You know, the correct answer was obviously that they should leave it up and they must be idiots to have made this mistake and taken it down. The problem is that large platforms like Facebook are operating at tremendous scale. They have distributed workforces of tens of thousands of employees with diverse cultural backgrounds who may or may not ever have seen this, what to us is an iconic photograph. And Facebook has to figure out a way to define a rule set that it can train all of these people on and have them apply it in a way that's supposed to lead to consistent outcomes and to just outcomes. And doing that at scale is just very, very different than making good judgment calls one case at a time. But we tend to, in the press or popular discussion, we tend to think about one case at a time because those are very graspable and they're narrative. It always involves a story that something sort of that grabs us and that we have strong opinions about. So I think we just get distracted from the large scale operational aspect of the picture, and that part of it is really important.
And I mean, the scale is truly really difficult to get your head around. I mean, these are millions of decisions per day that these platforms are having to make. But I guess, on the other hand, the really large platforms are the ones that can often comply with onerous regulations. And so do you think that going forward, and when we're thinking about the laws, that there needs to be more differentiation between how we treat these large systemically important platforms under the law versus the smaller ones that don't have that same scale?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because it feels like you could solve a lot of problems by having one rule set for the big guys and a different rule set for smaller operations. On the other hand, it's very hard to envision a rule set that didn't create a lot of unintended consequences. You know, so if you said, you know, once you have over X number of users or over Y revenues, then these new obligations kick in, that distorts the incentives of platforms that are in the smaller platforms that are in the process of growing. You know, it encourages larger platforms to artificially segment out their business, et cetera. So it's difficult to imagine a rule set that is perfect for treating the big guys differently. On the other hand, if we don't treat the big guys differently, we will get rules that only they can follow. I mean, it is very strange when you go to Capitol Hill and talk to members of Congress or their staff, they'll say, oh, we talked to tech, you know, we got their input, and they, you know, they negotiated or failed to negotiate, and the result is this legal draft. And if you say, well, who are you talking about? When you say you talked to tech, who did you talk to? Well, they talked to Google, and they talked to Facebook, and maybe they talked to the Internet Association, which has a number of members, but Google and Facebook are very prominent among them. And when that's your negotiation process, or when the big guys are who laws drafters have in mind, you wind up with standards that only the big guys can afford to comply with. There's a pretty egregious example of this right now pending in Europe, is the terrorist content regulation. And it's in a final negotiation stage, so we don't know how it will come out. But two of the three drafts going into the final negotiation stage had a filtering requirement and said that any platform of any size, including platforms based far outside of Europe, but who have some users there, can be compelled to build a filter to try to catch quote unquote terrorist content. And that is a very expensive undertaking, and something that I think roughly 13 platforms have already done, using an available database of hashed images of violent extremist images and videos. But if we think of the, I don't know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of small operations out there that could be caught in the net of this law, most of them just can't even begin to incorporate that kind of technology in their systems.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about that terrorist content regulation, because it's an interesting puzzle. So can you just walk me through sort of what it is that it would do, and also like, why now? What is it now that is motivating the EU to push forward with this?
Well, I think what's motivating it is a very legitimate fear of violent extremist attacks. You know, they've had terrifying and tragic attacks on populations in Brussels and London and Paris. And so I think they're understandably very much want to do whatever they can to reduce the danger of something like that happening in the future. But it's not entirely clear that new laws for the internet are going to be the most effective way to do that. And, you know, many people charge that European law enforcement are spending a lot of energy getting videos and images taken offline, but not actually following up and prosecuting the people who put them there, or prosecuting people or investigating people who potentially are at risk of actually engaging in real-world violence. So this law, the terrorist content regulation, does a handful of things. And Perhaps the most alarming, aside from the filtering mandate, is that it would empower law enforcement to order any platform to take down content within 1 hour. So it doesn't go through a court. This isn't a court looking at something and deciding that it constitutes illegal violent extremism. It's potentially, you know, local law enforcement. And we know from experience that European law enforcement has come to the Internet Archive, for example, and asked them to take down magazines that were parodies of ISIS put up by people engaging in counter speech against ISIS. But the, you know, police in France mistook it for the real thing and told the Internet Archive to take it down. We know that mistakes get made all the time, and having the law enforcement have this sort of global ability to go out and make things disappear within an hour without going through judicial review is a striking departure from the rules so far.
So there's a lot going on in Europe at the moment in this area, by contrast perhaps to the US, where there's a lot of more heat than light. Or the other way around. But before, including some really important Court of Justice decisions from the EU last week or the week before, but before we move on to that, why should people in other countries or other jurisdictions worry about what's happening, or watch what's happening in Europe? And I think it goes to what you were just saying about giving law enforcement a global power. How does it affect these platforms in the other jurisdictions in which they operate?
European law and norms are already very much shaping what we see on the internet in the rest of the world. And so it is absolutely worth paying attention to what's happening there, because it will very directly shape our experience of the internet. Now, in fairness, we are coming out of a period of a decade or two in which American law and norms very much shaped what the rest of the world saw on the internet. I think many Europeans feel like they, you know, suffered from American platforms exporting US speech rules and, you know, effectively imposing the First Amendment on the rest of the world. So I don't mean to point the finger at Europe or say that they are alone in wanting to export their norms. But the exporting that's happening is really quite explicit at this point. So, for example, there was an agreement called the Hate Speech Code of Conduct that was negotiated by the European Commission governance body with Twitter, Microsoft, YouTube, and Facebook, in which all four of those platforms agreed that for their hosted services, they would incorporate in their terms of service a prohibition on hate speech that tracked European law. So they take something that has roots in European law and they put it into their terms of service, which are enforced for the whole world. And the result is that those platforms have, at a minimum, the hate speech prohibitions that European law would provide, even in countries like the US that have different speech standards. So the net effect of European rules shaping the rest of the world is, you know, happens even without European courts issuing orders that require that global enforcement, which is what we saw emerging over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, so we'll get to those court orders in just a second. But before we do that, I want to ask, in the United States, as we've discussed, the mood has really shifted quite dramatically, at least in Washington, D.C., over the last couple of years. And there is at least a political appetite for a greater regulation, perhaps imposing some kind of obligation on these big platforms, at the very least, to moderate content more aggressively, though, as Evelyn says, that hasn't really amounted to anything yet. In your view, is this sort of the US moving toward a more European way of looking at the problem, that the two are kind of converging, or is the gap still pretty unbridgeable?
I think the US and Europe are wrangling with a similar set of problems, and in many cases arriving at a similar set of solutions. But the problems tend to be a big, like, gnarly mess of privacy issues, competition issues, speech issues, sometimes discrimination issues. You know, there are many, many pieces here. And so I think on the privacy front, there are lots of Americans who would like to see U.S. law track European law more and have something that looks more like the GDPR. You know, in many of these areas, I think the U.S. and Europe are experimenting with similar ideas. For the speech issues, I think it depends who you talk to in the U.S. You know, there's this very incoherent conversation in D.C. right now about CDA 230, which is one of the core intermediary immunities in the U.S. that makes platforms immune from a very wide array of legal claims for user speech. You hear criticism often from the left saying that if we could just get rid of CDA 230, then platforms would take down more speech, take down more content, more bad content, offensive or harmful content. And so there's the idea that we can serve that goal, getting platforms to take down more content by getting rid of or modifying 230. And at the exact same time, you hear an argument more often from the right that platforms are taking down too much content and that if we modified or got rid of CDA 230, we could serve that goal to get platforms to stop taking down so much content. And it just can't be the case that the same law is simultaneously causing them to take down too much and causing them to take down too little, or that getting rid of CDA 230 would solve both of those problems. But the state of the conversation is such that people seem to be pursuing those two conflicting goals through the same legislative means of getting rid of CDA 230.
And so in your view, is there any case to be made that 230 is kind of, I don't know how to put it, an artifact of an earlier age of the internet, perhaps, that we've outgrown it, that there is some argument for reform, albeit certainly not as sort of clumsy and ham-handed as many of its opponents are arguing? Or is this really a case where people are kind of looking for an easy fix and they've seized on 230, but 230, you know, is just as useful now as it was in the 90s when it was first implemented, even though we seem to be facing a sort of unprecedented array of problems?
I think CDA 230 is doing some of the same work now that it did in the 90s and some different work. So the work that's the same is it makes it possible to launch a new technology that transmits or hosts people's speech. And in the 90s, we didn't have big, powerful companies doing that, or we didn't in the way that we do today. And so this was the law that allowed those companies to come into being. But now, if we want new competitors to be able to challenge today's incumbents, they very much need the shield of an immunity so that they can come into being. If we take away the certainty and the protection from expensive litigation that CDA 230 provides to little companies, I don't think we can expect competitors to today's big incumbents to rise very easily. So, you know, that part of it, I think, has remained the same. What's different, one of many things that's different, is that we have a handful of very big companies who are operating in a way as gatekeepers for what the Supreme Court has called the modern public square. You know, it's just this very different dynamic in which 230, among other things, is protecting the discretion of a Facebook or a Twitter or a YouTube to decide what speech appears in a place where many, many people convene wanting to get their messages across. So that feels different to me from the 90s. But I think in some corners of the conversation about platform power, people make the case that platforms, because they are the, you know, quote, modern public square, should have to host anything the First Amendment permits. And I think that is I think most people probably would not like the result if that happened. You know, if Facebook couldn't take down racial epithets or porn or bullying or all of the offensive but lawful speech that they choose to take down under their terms of service, and if we all had to confront that material every day, I think users wouldn't enjoy it. Advertisers wouldn't like it. It would affect the value of Facebook as a sort of forum for civil discourse. So I think it is hard to know what we should be asking for to address the new prevalence or prominence that platforms have in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, you only need to look at your spam folder in your email account to sort of have a frightening glimpse of what Facebook would look like if it had to carry everything permitted under the First Amendment. Let's fly back to Europe again and talk about these Court of Justice decisions. When these massive decisions come down, I can see everyone on Twitter collectively going to your Twitter account to get the breakdown. You are one of the preeminent authorities on this. So there were two particularly major decisions in recent weeks. Do you want to just run us through basically the big takeaways from those two decisions?
Yeah. So there was a ruling 2 weeks ago about Google and the right to be forgotten, which spoke to whether France could order search results to be delisted globally. And then there was an order a week later in a case about Facebook and Austria that also addressed global takedown. And then that case also had a filtering component. It had a question of whether the court could order Facebook to build a technological filter to block people from saying certain things. So maybe I'll start with the global piece, and then we can come back to the filtering piece later. Both the Google case and the Facebook case, in my opinion, ultimately said the same thing. They were reported very differently in the press, but in both cases, the upshot was sometimes national authorities can require global takedown. And in the Google case, the court spent a long time talking about the balance between privacy and free expression and how different countries resolve that balance differently, so that in some, it might be that in France, the right outcome under the law is that a certain search result should be taken out of Google search results page, but that might be the wrong outcome in another country. And the court talked about the need to, you know, respect the different positions taken in law by different democracies that were acting consistent with human rights. But ultimately, it said, sometimes national courts in Europe can order global delisting in order to protect privacy or data protection rights under the right to be forgotten. In the Facebook case, the court did none of this throat clearing or did none of this laying out of principles and considerations. It just sort of cut to the chase and said, yeah, Austria, sometimes you can order global takedown. Look at your own law and decide when you can do that. So we will see both of these cases go back to the lower courts in their respective countries, and we'll see new cases arising in both of those in countries throughout the EU where people are asking a national court to order a global platform to take content down globally. And I think we will see some pretty erratic outcomes. I think national courts will have very different ideas of when it is appropriate to enforce their rules globally.
So let's zoom in a bit on the second of those decisions about the defamatory material. And the content concerned in that case was comments about a politician that in many jurisdictions would not only be considered permissible speech, but highly protected political speech. I'm going to paraphrase, but it was a politician who was called a corrupt oaf. You can correct me or fill in the details. But I'm just wondering, what capacity is there for these, if this now has been ordered to be taken down worldwide by the Court of Justice, what capacity is there for these platforms to protect the rights of their users in other jurisdictions who might want to hear this kind of speech? Or is there just no sort of, is it naive to think that they might be a bulwark for human rights in other jurisdictions?
Well, the Google case where the court just spent more time talking about these things, indicated that in some cases it should be sufficient for the platforms to just try to keep users in one country from seeing the speech while leaving it up for people in other countries. And the obvious technology for doing this is geo-blocking, where you look at the user's IP address or other indication of their location in the world, and then you show them only the content that's legal in their country, and you block the content that's illegal somewhere else. So there's a technical mechanism to try to comply with Austria's law in Austria and, you know, stop people from calling politicians corrupt oafs, but allow Americans to call their politicians corrupt oafs. But in terms of legal mechanisms, if Austria's court takes the position that Facebook absolutely has to take this down globally, there's not much that Facebook can do about it. You know, Facebook, I think I noticed in the Twitter responses when the case came down, there seemed to be a lot of people who thought that the First Amendment mattered here. The First Amendment doesn't matter here. The only consequence of the First Amendment is that if Austria, or if the plaintiff in this case, wanted U.S. courts to enforce the order, U.S. courts would probably refuse to do so, saying that it was inconsistent with the First Amendment, or that it was inconsistent with a law called the Speech Act that is about enforcement of foreign defamation judgments. But Austria doesn't need to have a U.S. court enforce this. Austria has its own leverage, and the European Union broadly has its own leverage, because Facebook makes a lot of money in Europe. They don't want to have their access to that market cut off. They want to keep being able to sell ads there. They want to keep being able to have offices open there. And so the incentive to comply with an Austrian order and avoid having Austria use its power as a state to enforce its judgment, that incentive is quite strong. In this particular case, you know, it's such a showcase, so high profile, and so many people are paying attention, that I won't be surprised if Facebook does what I think Andrew Wood predicted in Lawfare, which is, you know, try taking it to a U.S. court and get an order saying that, of course, it's unenforceable here, and bring that back to Austria and show it to the Austrian court, which already knew perfectly well that the order was unenforceable here. That won't be news to them. But you know, it might be that Facebook will go through that song and dance once. And maybe if there's another very high profile case, they might do it again. But at the end of the day, the Austrian court can do what it wants using its own powers. And at the end of the day, it does not seem likely that American platforms are going to litigate over and over again to avoid that outcome.
That's really useful. Thank you. So let's move to the filtering part of the decision and the aspect of the court's order that concerned identical or equivalent content. Could you explain for us what the court was talking about there and what your concerns are with that part of the order?
I don't think the court knew what it was talking about there, so I certainly can't explain it. So the court said Facebook could be compelled to take down any content identical to the statement that the lower court in Austria had deemed defamatory, and also anything equivalent. And they said it's equivalent if it has the same meaning. So seemingly that would mean that Facebook has to go find synonyms for corrupt oaf or synonyms for lousy traitor, which is the other phrase in the case, and make sure to block those also. But if that's what it means, if this is a matter of Facebook blocking every time someone uses those words, the risk of overblocking is tremendous. You know, people use the phrase corrupt oaf in joking with their friends. They use it in reporting on this case. They use it in all kinds of ways that have nothing to do with this case. And if every single time that those words turn up, Facebook automatically blocks it, the false positives and the over blocking of lawful speech will be very, very substantial. In particular, because the third phrase that was deemed defamatory here was fascist party. The user said that this politician, who was the head of the Green Party at the time, was a member of a, quote, fascist party, unquote. Well, people need to be able to use the phrase fascist party unfortunately, to talk about contemporary politics and to talk about history. That can't be a phrase that is prohibited on Facebook without a vast amount of unintended consequences for ordinary speech. But maybe, so as far as anyone can tell, that's what the court means, is that Facebook is supposed to go out and stop people from using these words or stop people from using synonyms for these words. But there's another interpretation of the order that in a way is even creepier, which is one of the lower courts in Austria said, Facebook, you have to stop people from using these words in conjunction with images of the plaintiff, photographs of the plaintiff. From a free speech perspective, that seems a little better because you can still use the phrase fascist party talking about something else. You know, you're only blocked from saying it when you also have an image of this plaintiff in your post. But from a privacy perspective, that version of the filtering order is pretty remarkable. That would mean that Facebook has to run biometric facial recognition scans on photos that people upload to figure out if they are photos of this individual and then check if these prohibited words appear next to it. And that interpretation, while plainly part of the case below in Austria, doesn't seem to have been discussed in the briefs that the case reviewed. Nobody seems to have brought up the privacy or data protection implications of mandating facial recognition technology. So that the case is a mess, and it's a mess in large part because it's really not clear what filter the court is talking about making Facebook use. But the court assumes, and I think Andrew Woods does in his Lawfare post, assumes that this will be a filter that doesn't have a bunch of false positives and that doesn't accidentally block a bunch of other lawful speech, but it never defines what the filter is or does the empirical inquiry to actually establish what benefits it's creating for the plaintiff versus what burdens it is creating for Facebook's other users.
One of the things this gets to, which I think is really interesting, is how courts often seem to sort of overestimate the capacity of artificial intelligence tools and filtering to successfully monitor content. So one of the examples that you've written about that I think is a great way to kind of explain this is the Scunthorpe problem. So can you just walk us through what that is?
The Scunthorpe problem is the name of a Wikipedia entry. And I assume that it is a phrase in larger use beyond that Wikipedia entry. But basically, it's the class of problems where people use very basic text filters that automatically detect particular words or strings of text and then block them. And so if you think about the word Scunthorpe, it has a four-letter word in the middle of it, which many filters would think was a dirty word and prohibited and would block. And so there are just all kinds of notorious examples, many of them from 90s era sort of net nanny type software of perfectly innocuous town names or book titles or web pages being blocked because they happened to have strings of text in them that were indistinguishable to a filter from a dirty word or a prohibited word. But most of the filters you hear about today are things like the photo DNA system for identifying child sex abuse images, or the GIFCT database for identifying images and videos that have been flagged as violent extremism. You know, those have a slightly different problem, because generally when they catch a duplicate of a prohibited image or video, the thing that they flagged really is a duplicate with some margin of error, but the technical accuracy of identifying duplicates is relatively high. The problem is that for violent extremist content, many things that are illegal in one context are legal in a different context. And so, you know, a video that's used by ISIS for recruiting in one context needs to be available for journalists and for scholars and researchers and people engaging in counter speech to use in other ways. you know, there are other ways of using it that are perfectly legal. And if you deploy a filter, even if it's very good at identifying duplicates and taking down a duplicate of something that was previously flagged as illegal, it's going to catch these new contexts also. You'll get things like what happened with the Syrian Archive. The Syrian Archive is a civil society organization dedicated to tracking evidence of human rights abuses and war crimes in Syria so that they can be used by human rights prosecutors in the future. And they had a big archive of videos stored on YouTube, and they got taken down. They lost over 100,000 videos that were being archived for this, you know, very pro-public interest purpose because they were indistinguishable from videos used by bad guys for bad purposes.
So I will say all of this sounds quite dire, right? We have all this content. Some moderation clearly needs to happen, and yet these filtering mechanisms create problems like you've just described. The Congress in Washington, D.C. is throwing out all these ideas that make absolutely no sense. So in this context where we're faced with these problems and also a growing consensus that the prior status quo isn't really good enough, what do you think is a more productive way forward? Or what kinds of questions would it be productive to ask in order to find that way forward?
I'll circle back to what I like about NetsDG, which is transparency. I think that if we want to make good rules for platform content management, we need to understand the facts about what platforms are capable of, what filters are capable of, what rules tend to lead to what outcomes, what patterns of errors might be taking place in platforms' content removal operations. We need to know all of those things. Otherwise, we're just making up rules and guessing about what might work. And so I think that every new report that comes out under NetsDG, every new transparency report that comes out, every new bit of information that we get will help move us toward being able to make smarter decisions and smarter rules. Now, one of the biggest barriers, unfortunately, is that independent experts can't decide whether platforms are doing a good job of taking down the right content unless the independent experts get to see what actual content came down. And it's pretty rare that anybody gets to see that. Usually what people get to see is aggregate data where a platform tells you the number of things that it took down and the number of notices that it operated on that came from government, for example. We see numbers, but we don't see the actual content that came down, and so we can't second guess them. We can't say, hey, it looks like you are being overly cautious and taking too much in this category of speech, or not cautious enough and taking down too little in this other category of speech. We can't know if there are patterns of bias that lead some groups to be silenced more than others, which is a claim that's been made by conservatives. It's also a claim that has been made by Black Lives Matter activists. You know, people from all across the political spectrum think that they are seeing disparate impact in the platform's content takedown decisions, but nobody is ever going to be able to prove it one way or another or be able to respond intelligently without better information about what's coming down. So I think, you know, I think an important first step should be to figure out ways to get more transparency and to get better information into the hands of experts and lawmakers so that we can have a more informed conversation and come to rules that will actually work.
So you and others have been calling for this kind of transparency and accountability for a while now. And you also had a Twitter thread go viral a little while back with platform policy bingo, the kinds of things that you hear again and again at the now plentiful conferences and panels about platforms and speech and liability, which suggests that perhaps maybe these conversations are getting a little repetitive. Have you seen progress in the past few years? Are we getting anywhere, or is it sort of stuck at the moment?
Well, both, perhaps. I think the conversations are repetitive in part because they're so important. And so there are constantly new people coming to the conversations who haven't already talked about, you know, why counter notice processes are important and haven't already talked about the value of transparency, et cetera. And so it's just inevitable that as people go through this learning curve, we go through saying the same things, you know, that some of those of us who live at conferences like these have heard 1,000 times. So that's fine. It, you know, it's important that everybody participate in this conversation who needs to. It's important that the people who are actually going to pass the laws get brought up to speed. And if the cost of that is some repetition, that's fine. That's how people learn things. That's how we all learned to talk. But then we do need, all right, hope that we will move beyond the sort of the repetition to something that can actually be useful. And I do think that there are moves toward transparency that count. So there is a proposal that came from the French government last spring that would essentially give a regulator the power to mandate and oversee transparency and view that as a first step prior to making substantive rules. So I think that kind of idea is an important step forward. There are proposals in Europe for what get called duty of care models, which are not what Americans think they are, that might possibly be good ways to move forward. So the idea there is not to create a tort standard. Americans tend to think of duty of care as meaning when you get sued, you have to show that you met a duty of care. That's not what these proposals are about. These proposals are about having a regulator who understands the internal operations of content moderation systems, and the regulator assesses whether a platform's operations overall meet a certain duty of care. And so even if there are individual failures where a platform fails to take something down when they should have or takes down the wrong thing, that it's okay as long as their overall system meets some kind of standard of fairness and transparency and reasonably consistent outcomes and so forth. So maybe there's a way forward with that. I have yet to see the tires really thoroughly kicked on those ideas. But, you know, there are new ideas coming along, and I think eventually we will, you know, after about 1,000 more conferences and 1,000 more games of platform bingo, we will come to a smarter system than the one we have now.
Well, on that moderately hopeful note, let's end here. Daphne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the second episode of Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast's new mini-series on disinformation. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare Podcast feed. And remember to check for new episodes every Thursday, or as we've been calling it around the office, Disinformation Wednesday. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Daphne Keller. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and our audio engineer was Jacob Schultz. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on whatever podcasting app you use. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.